Hey everyone, it's the Lookout Landing Podcast After Dark. Let's call this Lookout Landing After Dark. It's 8:45 on Saturday night, and it's just me and Patrick. We're hanging out, and we're doing a little impromptu podcast. We don't have anything planned. We'll see how it goes. Could be a train wreck, could be awesome. Patrick, how's your night going?
It's going okay. I've got a glass of Beringer White Merlot. I get a headache with every sip.
White Merlot? What?
Yeah, no, it's terrible. I don't know why I'm drinking it.
And it's Beringer.
Well, we opened it, and so I feel compelled to finish off the bottle. I'm about a fifth of the way through that bottle, and I'm already questioning that. But, I'm not a coward.
Can you explain to me what a white Merlot is? I didn't even know this existed.
I really can't. I think basically it looks like a regular Merlot if you poured water into it.
So it's still reddish?
It's translucent, more so than a regular Merlot.
Bit of a rosé color, perhaps?
Yeah, deceptively like a real glass of wine.
Okay,
all right. But otherwise, I'm fine. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing wonderful. It's not like I'm doing much better. I'm drinking a Bud Light. I had a couple IPAs at dinner, and now I get back to the house, and I'm like, oh, I'll have another beer. What do I have left over? Bud Light from the Super Bowl party. Okay.
Did you expect to be winning at this point?
Yeah. It's two quality beverages for a Saturday night as we sit on the computer and talk to each other about baseball. Quite luxurious lives we lead. Really doing a good job breaking that stereotype about baseball writers, am I right?
Oh, man. The Bud Light actually probably more apt. I would go get PBR, but...
See, Bud Light is pretty... like jock-ish. I mean, I suppose when the next time someone says, have you ever even played baseball? I'd be like, listen, bud, I'm drinking a Bud Light. So you tell me.
You don't know.
So about this spring training? My goodness, what a shit start to spring training.
Yeah. To prepare for tonight, I went on Twitter and I typed in hashtag Mariners.
Wow, look at you.
I decided to let it wash over me. And I realized that I'd almost missed out on the big news of the day.
Which is what? Justin Smoke's contract?
Justin Smoke's contract, yeah.
That is weird. I've never seen someone go to arbitration and instead of when they settle outside of arbitration, they say, yeah, we'll do one plus option while you're still club controlled. That's so weird.
And the option, the team option is $150,000. It was $150,000 buyout. Which is basically saying, please don't run away from me. Don't leave me in a grocery store. That's what it feels like. Like at least give me a parting gift when I'm inevitably cut from this team next year.
Right. I guess I don't really understand it. It just seems like I understand from the Mariners' perspective. I think it's a great contract for the Mariners. But from Smoke's contract or perspective, why would you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. You could at least
you give up all your leverage.
Right. You at least go to, it's not like arbitration ever makes sense. You may as well throw yourself behind the maelstrom of fate and basically you'll get a raise because everybody gets a raise.
Everybody.
Nobody loses money in arbitration. It never happened. It hasn't happened since like 93 or something. So
yeah.
I don't know either. Maybe he's feeling guilty. Maybe he feels like he needs to restore the karmic balance a little bit. And that's why he can't hit.
Right. He just provided the Mariners with one of the worst age 25 first baseman seasons in history. And then one of the worst 26-year-old first baseman seasons in history. And now he's still getting another shot. So he says, look, I know you guys are being ridiculously patient. So why don't I go ahead and throw you a bone here?
Yeah, a really worthless bone. Not that many bones have value other than, mammoth tusks.
Right. Okay, but, so I've been out all day. Now, the way I saw it described was it was a vesting option, not a team option. Has anything come out? I just got home. Or has anything come out about the terms of that vesting option? Or is that something?
I saw them, and I can't remember what they are. I believe there's a plate appearance threshold, but let me check to make sure.
Okay, I got it up here. Let's see. 525. It becomes a team option. 525 plate appearances. Okay, that's a good amount of plate appearances.
Yeah, I certainly don't expect him to get there. I hope he doesn't get there.
Says he had 521 last year. Of course, he spent some time in the DL this year, but he was also ineffective through the second half. Man, that is a weird contact structure. I like it. I mean, I like it more than I like Justin Smoak. So
yeah, I guess it's fair enough. I mean, it's an ARB contract. It's hard to really care too much one way or the other about it. He was going to get paid.
Yeah.
So
what's going to be interesting is if a team somehow, maybe a team has a first baseman go down, a contending team, and then Justin Smoak then becomes this big kind of question mark at the trade deadline, doesn't he? Because that vesting option will carry over. And what if a team that wants to trade for him says, well, we have to have him play every day, but we don't want to necessarily have his option vest.
So he's worth more to us. I mean, he was almost already worth more to us not playing. Now,
you know, I agree.
Even more we don't know, which, you know, makes Kendrys Morales make more sense. You know, I'm sick of the offseason. I'm sick of having to deal with these kind of, you know, Sophie's choices of baseball and having to try figure out what is nominally less worse for my fandom about these choices that I have to make.
I put off the so SB Nation is doing like a real fancy smancy MLB preview this year, and it's all, like, you know, produced and stuff like that, like they've done for the NFL and the MLB, and I had to turn in our kind of section of it. And I procrastinated for as long as possible because, you know, some of the sections are like key additions. And I'm going, well, we're still waiting.
We got one. We got addition.
Yes, we have an addition. We have, hey, I got Hart, Morrison, and Cano as the key additions. But the whole dynamic changes. If they go out and they get Nelson Cruz and they trade for a pitcher, or they get Chris Capuano or something like that, this whole offseason totally changes.
We just talked about Chris Capuano changing anything.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, at this point, anything that adds a couple wins, hey, I'll take it.
Yeah, I guess. I don't dislike Chris Capuano. I just think that he really is the point where, like, he's the backup quarterback in the sense that if he's playing, you can make the game more tolerable, but You're not making the Super Bowl.
Are we going to call him the Ryan Fitzpatrick of major league pitchers at this point, bouncing around on 1 year deals from place to place?
That's fair. That's fair. Like the kind where you might still win. You know, it's
sure awesome. You can win with him, but if you're playing a good team, he's probably going to throw six picks.
Yeah. But yeah. So, you know, even Logan Morrison. I mean, I don't know if. Is he key? What is key? What are we talking about? We talk about key transactions.
I don't know. I had to bite my tongue when I was writing about him to be like, is he a key addition or is he the key douchebag addition? Because he is kind of a douchebag, let's be honest.
Well, yeah. And it's funny because I was looking at the roster and they have Morrison listed as an infielder, which made the outfielder section of the roster that much more comical.
It's paper thin when you look at it. It's actually kind of absurd looking at the outfield on paper, and you're like, yeah, not a single one of these players can play center field. No one can legitimately play center field on this team.
And Ackley is actually listed as an outfielder on that roster, so so it could have been even worse if they listed him as a second baseman. I don't know who half these people are. I know James Jones, but only as a wide receiver for the Packers.
Exactly. That's the kind of shape we're in, right? Our outfielders play wide receiver for the Packers.
Right. Although he doesn't, he has number 99, which makes him instantly likable.
Okay. All right. I'm a double zero fan. I want to see someone walk up there with a double zero. That's what I'm talking about.
I thought we retired it. Jeffrey Leonard has that forever. And if anybody else wears it, Jeffrey Leonard will show up and he will beat the crap out of that guy. So, I, you know, obviously.
Didn't they used to call him Penitentiary Face?
Yeah.
That's one of the best forgotten nicknames.
Formal retirement.
Oh, my gosh, that's good.
A stubborn, silent one. Yeah, so, all right. So, it's bad that when I looked at this roster, the first thing I thought was, wow, this out of the park 15 is going to be tough this year.
I think about that too all the time. I can't wait for out of the park 15. By the way, the screenshots look fantastic. I don't know if you've seen any screenshots. It looks like they've kind of revamped the design and they look great.
I haven't looked at it yet. I've never looked at the preview of any game since Diablo 2.
Did you play 3?
I did play 3.
Underwhelmed. I was underwhelmed.
Yeah, it was pretty mediocre.
I hated the auction house. I thought it took all the fun of finding items out of it.
Well, it's not broken enough. Games have to be... There's a certain level of brokenness that makes a game fun, because then you feel like you're the one person who exploited it and are enjoying the super advantage.
Right.
Yeah, so...
But now that someone writes a forum post and says, this is how you can break the game, you never have that sense of accomplishment anymore. I mean, I think back to when you could figure out how to break games on your own. It's like the stuff of legends. Like, I remember playing Mario Brothers, and there's that one level where you can, on the steps before you jump on the flag, you can kind of bounce on the Koopa like 1,000 times in a row and get unlimited, you know, one-ups and stuff like that. And I remember my babysitter showed that to me, and I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Here I am, 7 years old. My babysitter is showing me how to get 1,000 lives.
Now, to be fair, your babysitter and the internet aren't that different. I mean, you're still getting...
it is different, because one of them is just one person's opinion. And it might be true and it might not be, but you have to find out for yourself and they'll show you. The internet... All you have is just people going in the comments being like, fake, doesn't work, or, you know, thank you. All you got to see is the confirmation. Then you go, okay, I can do this now. It takes the fun out of it. There's no risk.
So, yeah, we're basically talking about the Mariners and Fangraphs again, right?
Sure. We can bring it back around.
No, I mean, that's pretty much how it feels, talking about the Mariners. So you say, oh, I could see the Mariners being good. No, we've already got people on the internet who have proven them.
Yeah, Zip says 77 wins, so that's it. Don't you dare.
So, yeah, I tweeted this a couple days ago, but I think that we need to... The solution to this is that we need to have our own World Series. We need to create our own World Series. And that World Series is 90 wins. If the Mariners win 90 games, on the 90th game, whenever we get there...
Parade?
Yeah, parade. Just treat it like, forget the rest of the country. Ignore them all. And just have a Seahawks level parade. Well, it wouldn't be Seahawks level because no one would come. But
I would come. I would go see that.
The 30 people we talked into this would just have a giant parade. We'd all storm down Fourth Avenue and treat it like, because that's what we have at this point, right? I mean, no matter, we can talk about Trader Z and everything, but really, there's so few things left that can be done.
Yeah.
We're basically hoping that the only way we have a chance at the playoffs now is attrition, right?
Right.
That every AL West team managed, and this doesn't even work in baseball, but just beats each other up. That there's no 90-win team in the AL West.
And then things just break the Mariners' way, and they don't break four other teams' ways.
Right.
Yeah.
And I feel more and more like there are three 90-win teams in the AL West, and we're just not one of them. Just
because
three good teams doesn't mean everyone's mediocre. It just means that we have a strong division, and, you know, I don't know. It's...
I could realistically see four 500-plus teams in the AL West this year. I could. I could see the Mariners squeaking over 81 wins. Now, obviously, some things are going to have to break right for them. They had 13 walk-off losses last year. If they switch that around and it goes the other way, hey, you can probably swing 5 extra wins out of that. That's baseball. You can make your best estimations, but sometimes you're going to win more games than you're probably supposed to. And right. I could see the Mariners having that kind of a year where they win 82, 83 games. I could definitely see the Angels, you know, kind of bouncing back and being really close to the Mariners. And then I see both Texas and Oakland as 90-win teams again.
Yeah, everyone loves the Angels. I'm not sure I see it.
I don't really see it either, to be honest. I see Mike Trout and I go, okay.
Yeah.
But I don't see a huge bounce back for Pujols and, you know.
For me, it's the pitching. I just don't see that they have the pitching that
everyone
else does. But I keep waiting for Jared Weaver to break every year. And I don't even have anything against the guy. I just He has to break.
He threw 86 miles an hour last year. I honestly think that was his average velocity in his fastball was something like 86. Now I got to look it up because I'm going to. Yeah. How dare you say that? First comment. What are you talking about?
It's pretty bad. Whatever it is. Hey, I just learned that Yorvis Medina has my birthday.
There you go.
Which means I now have any opinion about him.
Okay, I was close. 86.5 miles an hour was his average fastball last year. And I believe I looked that up, and no, I'm not going to look this up too, but it's, I think only one right-handed pitcher had a lower average fastball velocity this year, and it was R.A. Dickey.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right. He's made it work, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that
he's never thrown hard. He's never been like even a mid-90s guy. He's always kind of that guy that sat kind of 89 to 91 and just, you know, got by on location and good secondary stuff.
Yeah. Those guys, I mean, basically, they're more likely, it seems like, to fall off the cliff than the fastball guys. Yeah. I don't know if I read that somewhere or not, but it just seems like those guys, you lose one more mile per hour and then suddenly – nobody has to sit. Everybody can just sit on the offspring.
Right, that's it.
And still catch up. But
how much does that make you appreciate Felix? I mean, it's truly unbelievable. The guy has lost a lot of velocity, and last year he struck out more batters per inning than he's ever struck out.
It is crazy.
We don't
appreciate it enough.
I think about dominating pitchers, right? And I always go back to Eric Gagne. Oh, yeah, Eric Gagne threw 95, and then he throws changeup, and it goes 68. That separation is just crazy. Okay, well, Felix is now throwing his fastball 89, 90, 91, 92 a lot of time, and his change is like 6-7 miles an hour slower. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a way, it being that close is almost equally difficult, though, right? Because I think about as a hitter, if you can kind of sense the separation, it either has to be like way slower, like Gagne style, or it has to be almost the same velocity. And then obviously the bottom just falls out when Felix throws that change. It's just all of a sudden. But if it's coming off at the same kind of velocity, and then you've got to just basically make your best guess, is this going to hit the plate or is this going to be a strike?
And you have those hundredths of seconds to time it, right? I mean, the window is so small for hitting a baseball anyway that anything that throws off the timing, as long as you don't have a minute and a half to recover and then wait for the pitch, you didn't, you know, make up for your own mistake. But
Felix. As silly as this sounds and how analytical we are, we're like, oh, we don't care about ERA. I'd like to see him get his ERA back under 2 this year. Back under 3. He's been so close the past 2 years. And, you know, it doesn't really matter to me, but I know it matters to the players, and that's why I still kind of care about that stuff. It's why, as fans, we still kind of care, like, yes, get 20 wins, because we know the player cares.
Right.
And we care about them, and we root for them, so that's why we still care about, like, arbitrary milestones. Like, I don't care if a guy gets 200 hits. I don't care if he breaks any sort of threshold. It's one hit doesn't make a big difference, but to them it matters. We love them, so we want them to be happy. It's kind of a weird dynamic.
Oh, that's also nice when we can find the milestone that they didn't know existed too, right? It feels comforting to know that when a guy has an inflated ERA that we can say, well, actually, look at this guy's FIP, right?
Right. Or,
you know, look at his home run rate on fly balls. It's kind of nice to feel like we could, you know, potentially, we understand, as true fans, we appreciate the true greatness of this player that the masses don't.
Yeah, and isn't that funny? And then we ignore it when it goes the other way,
right?
Like with Asashi Iwakuma. You look at his peripherals, and they're not outstanding like his ERA was, and you're like, well, you know, the guy just knows how to pitch. You know, it's just like it's just like suspension of disbelief that we just have, where you just convince yourself that yes, that's how it is. And especially with some of these players too, where they constantly outperform their peripherals. Like Matt Cain was always the guy, right? Cain just continually. Is he underrated? Has he managed to beat the system? I don't know.
Finally, the year we decided that he had some hidden skill.
It blew up in his face.
And he blew up for half the season. Yeah, that's why it's so great that we have both Fangraphs War and Baseball Reference War. I think yes. They should never combine. I want them to be separate. I want them to be these kind of opposing viewpoints.
I do as well. And generally, when I'm looking forward, I'll use Fangraphs War for pitchers. I say war. I never say war, and I don't know. It just feels. I don't know. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I like using the Baseball Reference version for what a pitcher has accomplished.
Right.
Because it's in the books. It happened. Sure, maybe he got lucky. Whatever. I'm still enough of a. There's still enough traditionalist left in me that I can use an advanced metric that's results based and be like, sure, hey, I'm meeting you halfway here, right?
Yeah.
I'm looking at this advanced metric, but it's still based on run prevention and those games actually happen. And of course, it was influenced by the defense and by some luck and things like that. But still, it happened. So when I looked at Iwakuma last year, I mean, I think he was number two in the AL in WAR. I think he was the second. I think it was like seven. It was a big difference. He had, I think it was like 6.5 or 7 on Baseball Reference.
He led Baseball Reference.
He might have. And then it was, I think, 4 point something on Fangraphs. So there was a big split.
Yeah. I think part of it for me, and, you know, I write nominally for Fangraphs. So I feel like I owe Warm, you know, I should side with it. I like Baseball Reference more in the sense that I'm somebody who kind of gets annoyed by the idea that everything we talk about is insinuated as being a projection.
Right.
When I say, hey, this guy hit 20 home runs last year, there's this sort of insinuation that I mean it like it has anything to do with what he does this year, right? That by describing him, I'm projecting on him what I think. And I don't, you know, that's just the English language.
Yeah.
You can't get away from it. You can't get away with praising somebody without insinuating that you either like them or you think it's going to continue. And I don't really project much. I'm not an expert. And right. I don't like to insinuate. I like to live in the past more than I like to live in the present anyway when it comes to the baseball because... Sure. You know, with the Mariners, why would you pick the president?
yeah.
So in that sense, I kind of feel like, you know, when I talk about F4, I feel like I'm being roped into this theory that I can only describe things in what they mean for the future.
Right.
All that's valuable about baseball is trying to guess next time. And I'd rather, sometimes I just want to celebrate what happened, whether it deserved to or not.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you there. And it's like, I really like looking at projections and I like thinking about them and I like talking about them, but I don't like making them. You know, it was hard for me to kind of write something specific in the preview about how good is this team going to be. And I know that this is such a this team is going to be so volatile because we know what only a handful of the players are going to do. You know what Cano is going to do. You know what Felix is going to do.
Seager.
You have a pretty good idea of a handful of guys, and then the rest, they could be... the range is so high. Mike Zunino could be a 3-win player next year, or he could be a replacement-level player. Brad Miller could be a 4 or 5-win player, or he could be a 2-win player. The gap is so huge on these guys, and that's why I'm still excited for the season. I mean, even with everything crappy that's happened, is that we know deep down inside that there's so much young talent, and if by some miracle they all busted loose at once, this team could win 90 games. It could happen on this team. And I don't want to make the projections because I don't want to sour myself on that dream.
Well, and we've all conditioned ourselves to become general managers now.
Of course.
And why not? It's February. The Olympics are going on. There's nothing else to do with baseball, especially when nobody's signing anyone. We, out of the park and fantasy leagues, they've taught us to always be trying to estimate and trying to be as accurate as possible while estimating.
Right.
And that's great. Have fun with that. That's fun. I think that we now start to think about baseball players as being fixed assets, where there's this hidden, there's a hidden number in them. There's this true talent that is static and it exists inside them, and we just the only mystery is figuring out what that is. There is Justin Smoke is a specific player, exactly. He already has a war curve out in front of him that gets marred by certain things that happen, you know, injuries or playing time, these things, developmental issues. All these things change that line, but there was this predestined arc that he was supposed to take. And that's just so different than how people used to think about baseball.
Right. Yeah.
I was reading a book about by Roger Angel. He's writing about the Mets in the 60s. And so little of it is about building the team. Of course, they're an expansion era team, and it was before free agency. But even with trades and everything, when a player did badly after a trade, it was always the player's fault for not living up to the general manager's expectations in making the trade. It was never that the general manager just simply didn't, you know, recognize the talent. And so the drama of baseball at this time were these players. The responsibility was on the player to find and maximize their own ability. Whereas now we tend to think of it as how is our team builder, how is our general manager,
right,
pulling together to pull this talent out of these players.
And it goes so much more than that too. I mean, that's what's changed so much is that now, I think it's especially the access of information that we now have too. Like, we know exactly who all these people are in the front office all the way up the chain, right? And we have so many more different takes on them than, say, what you would read in a newspaper or what you would hear in hearsay. So when something goes wrong, they go, well, it's the manager, it's the coaching, and then it's the manager, and then it's the GM, and then with Mariner fans, it's always, it's the ownership. It's Chuck and Howie.
It's Chuck and Howie.
Why don't we have a face on our ownership? You know, why doesn't he come to our games? Okay, well, we're running out of excuses for that, right? Because the owner's dead and we've got a new president. So can we start getting back to putting a little bit of responsibility on the players? I mean, I totally see that thing too. And I've never been a guy that wants to go straight up the chain like that, because I think, especially if you're someone that's ever worked in a company and something goes wrong and it's like, it's not necessarily your fault. Do you really want to start passing blame around to everybody that's above you? Or do you want to pinpoint the problem?
Well, we assume there's blame, and we have to assume there's blame, right?
Because yes, we have to.
As Mariners fans, the alternative is that, you know, just terrible things happen over and over again.
We're not going to just accept that the team is bad without any explanation. I mean, come on.
And you know, when I look back on those older articles, a lot of old newspaper articles from that time, the blame was placed on the players, and that blame was equally idiotic.
Yes.
It was just as arbitrary, just as results-based as the blame we put on management now. Mm-hmm. It's still a desperate attempt to find understanding when we totally have no ability to do so. But it was more exciting because that untapped potential could be released at any moment. A player, we believed back then in clutch, which, you know, unfortunately, I actually wish clutch were true. I want clutch to be true. I want clutch to really exist as this powerful thing. I want the game-winning RBI to come back and for it to actually correlate meaningfully. So, because that's
exciting. Trust me, I tried. I wrote an article this year on Kendrys Morales because he is one of the few players in Major League Baseball who has consistently had a high clutch rating over his career. He's right. One of the only people that's done it. And I wanted to believe that it was true. I wanted to believe that it was a trait that you could develop. And I did a bunch of research on it, and it was completely inconclusive and frustrating. Yeah. And I wrote about it anyways because I was like, well, maybe someone will find this as interesting as me.
Well, you know, and you know, research failures are equally interesting to research successes anyway. But
sure.
But yeah, it's such a lure. And just because it's false doesn't mean it isn't pretty.
Hold on, my phone's ringing.
Oh, okay. That's...
After Dark. This is my ringtone. It's the NBA Jam theme song. I'm Super Nintendo. It's my wife. I told her if I don't pick up, it's because I'm podcasting. This is my life. All right, go ahead.
Okay, no, I just suddenly felt like I was about to select Kendall Gill.
Yeah.
God, I lost my train of thought now. I was on such a, I had such momentum.
I know, what were we just talking about?
We were talking about the desire for clutch.
Yes.
And you know, it is a shame that it's bad, and I'm glad from a research standpoint that the people who are trying to create successful baseball play teams are better at noticing these sort of flawed arguments as being flawed.
Right.
But at the same time, I have no responsibility over creating a successful baseball team, and I never will. And I feel a sense of loss at these myths because they would have helped. Like, it would have been really nice this year if we had something like that we could cling to, that the scientists right. all horribly wrenched from us.
It's fun, right? It's fun. Like, you can look at last year's team and you could say they lost, I think it's 13. They had 13 walk-off losses last year. And wouldn't it just be fun to just be like, hey, what if they won all of those this year? Like, yeah, think about it completely unscientifically and like you're a kid again.
Well,
what
as long as you're not projecting, as long as you're not saying it will.
Exactly. But you can dream.
There's no harm in it. You can say, I want this to take place without having authority to either make it take place or tell people it will. And that's why I'm not an analyst. I don't, you know, that
it's hard to keep the balance too, especially as a writer. Like, it's hard to provide realistic and worthwhile information that is founded in some sort of truth and reality, and still sometimes just say, when you watch a game, I don't care about anything. I kind of shut my brain off when I watch baseball. You know, I know a guy splits. I know, hey, this guy sucks against lefties, and this guy's got a 500 OPS against lefties, Andre Ethier style, right? I don't care. When I watch a game, I don't think about that at all. I never think about that. And I kind of can't let myself think about that, because to me, yeah, it's fun to know and kind of predict what's going on, but sometimes you just want to believe that anything can happen, because that's kind of the beauty of the sport anyways.
Well, and for me, I think I do keep that stuff in mind. And I always have a mental poker percentage thing in the bottom corner of the screen for me. Mm-hmm. Like, when you know you see that 10% chance to win based on the flop, yeah, I have that. I don't have the exact numbers, but I'll think, okay, well, this guy's up, this is a bad mashup, and I'll kind of mentally put that in. But that doesn't mean I don't want it to happen, and that doesn't, and actually makes it more rewarding when it does, right? When that unlikely thing happens, you get to appreciate exactly how unlikely it is, because you don't have to actually bet on it.
For me, it kind of prolongs the celebration. I'm excited when it happens, and then I go look at the WPA charts and I go, oh my gosh, we have 5% chance to win that game. That was amazing. And then I get inspired to, you know, really dive deeper into it. But, you know.
So I guess that's what the Mariners, this is our reward.
Yeah.
As Mariners fans, the light is so dim, the moment everything is so bleak, that those flashes of light, those ninth, right. Those bottom of the ninth grand slams, are that much more beautiful when they happen, because they should never happen.
I mean, how badly do you want this team to come out of April at 15-11 or something like that?
Wonderful. Like, now the Seahawks kind of ruin it a little bit. Because you can't get away from it, right? You have to talk about the success. And the Seahawks are so interesting because they were so... It was such a start-to-finish dominating performance.
Oh, my gosh.
They were not underdogs. They were not, you know... Last year, when they made their playoff run with Russell Wilson as rookie, that was unlikely.
Right.
But this time, there was nothing except potential loss. You knew they were the best team. They were the best team all year, basically. And you just had to wait to see if you were correct.
That's what was so weird, right? Is when they lost in Atlanta last year, the first thing I thought was, it's going to be a disappointment if this team doesn't win the Super Bowl next year.
Right.
And that's coming from a tortured Seattle fan. I've never had that ever. But that's how confident I was And it just is, it's so, so far removed from what we expect from the Mariners, where we think, hey, maybe a lot of things break right, and maybe they get that new second wild card spot, and maybe we have a one-game playoff, and maybe they win it, and then who knows what can happen. That's what we're rooting for now, is that maybe in a world, in a time, they'll have a chance for the second wild card spot.
Yeah.
For one game to bring them in. And then we'll be thankful that they installed that really stupid playoff format.
So with the Seahawks, I mean, they were great all year. And so we didn't have that this year as far as that feeling of being underdogs, the overcoming adversity, that stuff.
Right.
But with them, what it was is this 3-4 year plan. I can't remember if it's 3 or 4 years yet. But when they traded Darrell Tapp, when they traded for Chris Clemens, some part-time player that nobody wanted, all these moves that they made that were so opposite when everyone else thought was, it went such against conventional wisdom. That was their April.
Yeah.
And the Super Bowl is that culmination. It just happened to take longer than a year, mm-hmm. because most sports do.
Right. Yeah, it's a four-year plan. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, the feeling, there's no better feeling in sports than house money. That when, as a fan, knowing that really at this point, like the Atlanta game last year, you thought, oh, they're going to lose. When they lost, I was disappointed, but it was house money at that point. We were there was no way we were going to get that far into the playoffs with the rookie quarterback. The Mariners need to figure out where's the house money point at that part. Is if we're up, because there's so many different ways to get to an 81 win season, right?
Yeah.
Would you think it's better to win a bunch of games in April and May and then level back out? Or do you think it's better to climb up?
Climb up.
It's hard. But
It is hard, but I guess I would go with climb up, because then that gives you something to fantasize about for the next year. Whereas if you had a really amazing April and May, then I feel like your mind would start to say, well, it was a mirage and this team was terrible down the stretch and you don't have any momentum going in next year.
Probably a mirage either way, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Baseball's linear. But I think you think about young players and you want to believe the narrative and things like that, that, oh, they improved so much as they came along. And you have to kind of try and find this balance of what's real, what's fluke, what's a narrative, what's just regular, things balancing out across the regular season, and then you have to try and project. And here we are, back where we were just talking about 10 minutes ago,
Yeah. And you look at Ubaldo Jimenez, right? He had two incredible months,
mm-hmm.
and they happened to be the last 2 months. And you wonder, he's still not signed. He's talking now about just taking a 1-year deal at $13 million.
Jeez.
Which I would take.
I would. I want Jimenez, so.
But what if he has those 2 months at the beginning of the season? It's interesting because, yes, he doesn't finish in that way that gives him momentum. He probably doesn't inspire as much confidence from that standpoint, but at the same time, his numbers look really good most of the year, because you can't escape that temptation to look at a guy's numbers at the end of April, at the end of May. If the guy's,
especially since he had such a bad year in 2012 too,
right?
Because then you bring yourself into the, oh, he's fixed, he's back. I mean, once dominant, once terrible, suddenly dominant again, then that's where your mind rushes, is, oh, he figured it out again because he did it before.
Right. I mean, you look at Brian LeHair, and Brian LeHair had, what, like 3 decent weeks? And it just happened to be the first 3 weeks of April.
Right.
But those 3 weeks made his numbers look good enough for most of the year that he, first of all, he got into the All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that he'd long since stopped being an All-Star.
Right.
And it carried through, and he got another job the next year. Or did he? Maybe he didn't.
He go to Japan that did year?
I think he went straight to Japan after that.
I mean, he's back now. He signed a minor league deal with Cleveland, is that right?
Probably. They're signing everyone to minor league
deals. Yeah, it is Cleveland, yeah.
But it's just interesting. I don't know. I think that I'd prefer the first month because I prefer the feeling of the optimism. It's so hard to cultivate interest. Is, you know, obviously we dealt with last year at the end of the year, writing articles.
Yeah.
In September.
Oh, God.
Just you know, you get a free amount of fan base at the beginning of the year just because it's spring and it's lovely and outside.
Sure.
And anything that allows me to maintain my interest and maintain everyone else's interest, yeah, I'll take that all up front. I'll take that as quickly as I can get it, and we'll deal with it later when we get to it.
Yeah, I get that, because even if you surge at the end, if you're surging to 500, it's late enough that it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and it's kind of a hollow victory.
It's totally hollow. I mean, you're excited for development, but you don't have those delusional fantasies anymore. Whereas if you go, yeah, like I said, if you go 15 and 11 in April, all of a sudden you're thinking, hey, you know, we're two games back in the AOS. This is a tough division. Maybe this team is better. You ignore, you know, you ignore, oh, Kyle Seager is, he's got a 460, you know, BABIP. Okay, that's fine. That'll sustain. You just kind of convince yourself, well, look at his line drive rate. It's really up, you know?
Yeah, you can always find causes.
Sure.
So with all this said, with knowing that the Mariners are probably the same Mariners as last year with the Robinson Cano, what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? Every Mariners fan has to figure out how they're going to be Mariners fans.
Right.
And last year, one of the first articles I ever wrote for Lookout Landing was basically a guide saying, here are your ways to be a Mariners fan, and you have to choose one. You can either believe they're really going to win 95 games,
mm-hmm,
or 90 games, or you can believe in the process and you know, the creation of the talent, the 2010 Paul Schneider theory, or you can revel in the prospects and watch them grow. Which of those options are you going with?
I think I've got a little bit of a hybrid thing. I'm very excited to watch Taiwan and James hit or pitch, and I'm excited to watch Brad Miller's development, and I'm hoping that with this is a year we really get that Kyle Seager breakout that we were a little robbed for last year when he fell off.
Yeah.
I'm excited for all those things. But I have fond memories of, was it 2007 that the Mariners won 88 games?
I believe so.
I'm going to look it up real quick. Yeah, 2007. That was a very fun year to be a Mariners fan for me, because it allowed me to believe that something was possible for the longest amount of time. And I don't want, I guess what I'm rooting for this year is not that the team is going to make the playoffs, but they are going to provide me with the tiniest sliver of irrational hope into August and September. That's what I'm rooting for this year, that they keep themselves within single digit games back of first place so that you can think, hey, maybe if they, you know, manage to go 22-6 this month, they can get back in this, and maybe if the Rangers lose a bunch of games and things like that. I'm rooting for through August and hopefully September, but probably through August realistically, that every time I turn on the TV to watch a Mariners game, I care because it could mean something.
What do you think the odds of that happening are?
20%.
Okay.
I'll give it 20%. Right now, I see the Mariners as a dead 500 team. I think if they slightly below. I think if they go out and they get Nelson Cruz, I bring him up from 80 wins to 81 wins. I think that if they go out and get Nelson Cruz and perhaps trade some of their surplus for a pitcher, or they sign Capuano, okay, then maybe we're at 83 wins. You know, Irvin Santana or Jimenez probably brings them to 84 wins. I have a hard time thinking that this team is going to win 85 plus unless we get a true breakout from someone like Mike Zunino, who I just don't expect a true breakout from this year.
So I'm going to say the problem with that. That's a totally valid way to look at things.
Yeah.
And I would if I were a stronger person. however, I'm not. I'm broken. My fandom's going to be very different this year anyway, because I will be carrying around a toddler who will be trying to kill itself at all opportunities.
Right.
So baseball for me is going to be a very, very subconscious activity. It's going to be in the background as I am, you know, wresting sharp objects out of her hands. But in order for that to work, in order to bank on the 85 to potentially outperforming Pythag strategy, you have to invest a lot of emotion early on.
Right.
Right. Because I don't think the Mariners are the kind of team, if they do get to 86 wins, they're certainly not going to do it by starting off 650 and then, you know, dropping down to that point.
Yeah,
kind of hovering, and you're going to have to hope a lot and get crushed a lot, and then hope a little more and get crushed a little more. That's a lot of emotional investment on a team that has burned you many, many times, right?
Yeah, but we're still here. We're still here.
We are still here. I've been thinking about it, and I don't think that my fandom has anything to do with the Mariners winning.
Hmm.
I'm used to them not winning, and I like them anyway. This is partially because, you know, I grew up as a child of the 80s Mariners, where not only did they not win, they had never won. And right. They never win. It was not even that wasn't even part of it. The getting to have baseball meant just being there,
yeah,
to watch them lose. And so I'm totally comfortable with another 70 and 90 season.
I mean, I see where you're coming from. I mean, I could stomach it. Because obviously I could stomach it. I mean, yeah, we're here. We can stomach it. But I wouldn't say I'm okay with it.
I'm okay with it. I'd be happier if they won. Although,
right.
From a writing standpoint, that's a lot of pressure.
It's so true. I don't know what I would write about if I had to be optimistic all the time. I have not written about the Mariners in an optimistic point of view since 2009, and then I was writing maybe once a month.
Yeah, I certainly would hate to have to actually be accountable for anything I actually wrote. that's terrifying. But
hey, we did the off-season plan this year. We went out on a limb there.
Off-season plan. We got one part right.
I think we did really well in the offseason plan this year. I got to be honest.
I was happy with it.
Even the thing that was hardest for people to believe, which was the Austin Jackson trade,
right.
The Tigers still kind of ended up doing, right? They had a pitching surplus. They didn't trade Purcell. Instead, they traded Doug Fister, and then they went out and they got themselves a second baseman.
They got even less
than
we would have offered.
In theory, so, not that bad.
I was pretty thrilled with Ron Baskey for doing that. Yeah. I felt a little vindicated. But I just think – I think that for me, what I'm trying to do, I'm tired of playing the GM.
Yeah.
And I'm tired of trying to predict what they should do. And I just want to watch the players play. I think I'm becoming much more of an April to October fan of baseball, at least as far as present baseball is concerned. I'm, you know, during the off season, I'm happy to dwell in the past and look up stories and find weird things. But as far as the 2014 Mariners, I'm almost treating them like Diablo 2 now. Where once the season starts, once the game is out, that's when I'll invest.
That's when you'll invest.
That's when I'll care. And I'll care on an individual basis about these random, stupid players that probably shouldn't be playing. Like Justin Smoke.
Right. So what's equivalent to the purple text staff that you're going to find? what's the rarest thing that could happen that you would be just so thrilled that you managed to have in this season?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think that I personally am much more... I compared to most people, I think that I am much more interested in the single game accomplishments. I was the sort of kid who dealt out poker hands to myself. When I, you know, like, you're waiting for somebody or you're at a bus stop, I would just deal out five cards.
You don't have to justify that. I did that shit too.
So, you know, and what would happen? I'd deal myself four of a kind, and I'd be super proud of myself for, you know, no actual merit. But it didn't mean anything. It certainly had no indication of future success. It wasn't like I would be better at poker, you know, having done this, but it was cool.
Sure.
And so stuff like the perfect inning, that could happen at any time. I mean, there's no reason that any one person could not do it. The seven strikeouts to start a game.
Yep.
Which a record held by the immortal Jim DeShays. If Jim DeShays can hold that kind of record, I think somebody's tied him since.
Right.
Then it can happen to anyone, and it's cool when it happens. Those are the kind of things that I look forward to. The miraculous plays that you don't expect.
Right.
You know, throwing out Terrence Long at third. That one play is worth more to me than some entire seasons, because it's certainly far easier for me to encapsulate it, to appreciate it when I want to.
Sure.
Than say the 2005 Mariners.
Sure. I mean, especially when you're looking for things to cling on to. I mean, that for me, like, it's so funny. I mean, how Mariners fan is this? But the thing I always think about last year, my fondest memory, is Kyle Seager hitting that extra innings grand slam to extend the game. I mean, that is, and then the Mariners lost that game.
Yep.
But that's,
of course they did.
Of course they did. But that's now, the happiest I've been.
I actually, you know, now detached from that moment, I actually think it's great they lost the game. it works so much better in the framework of Marinerdom that they lost than if they'd won.
Yeah. How would you write about it if they managed to win that game? It wouldn't be nearly as fun.
Well, it'd be fun at the time, but not as fun now.
Exactly. You gotta think
about what is the Scott of February 2015? What is he going to be happy about? Stop thinking about yourself so much. Think about your other self.
Oh, gosh. I got to plan things out better than that. I mean, come on. Oh, God.
But, yeah, those are the kind of things I'm going for right now. The things, you know, it's baseball is silly and arbitrary and pointless, and the things that make you have fun with it are especially now. I mean, sure, they could get good, and once they do, I'll flip the switch, right? Yeah. I was a long-suffering Seahawks fan. I watched during the Dan McGuire era.
Oh, of course.
And the John Freese era and all those other eras. And, you know, when they got
Stouffer,
good.
Kelly Stouffer, Stan Gelbaugh.
Yeah. So when they got good, I flipped the switch. I was ready to be, you know, a real fan at that point. But in the meantime, you know, I was throwing tomatoes like anyone else, and that's fun, and it's certainly more fun than killing yourself over you know, these prospects that nobody can control and that just happened to come out, you know, terrible five times in a row.
But didn't we learn something? I mean, for me, I really learned something about myself when the Seahawks won this year, because, you know, I mean, baseball is my first love, but I really love football, and I love the Seahawks too, and I always have. And that moment when they won, and I went down to the parade, and I was experiencing it with the whole city, and you just kind of realize that all the joking and all of the self-deprecating situations that you discuss with the franchise, like the Seahawks, who have had more success in a lot of ways than the Mariners, I mean, the release.
Yeah.
It is euphoric and confusing, isn't it? it is amazing, because you have this giant release of energy that you don't know what to do with. You don't know how you're they say act like you've been there before, right? That's the act like you've been there before. And I haven't ever.
No.
I've never been there. The Huskies won the national. That's one of my. I mean, I remember the Huskies winning the Rose Bowl in 1992.
91.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, 91 season, 92 Rose Bowl. And I was 8 years old, and that was the greatest thing to me. But I was eight. I couldn't process emotion. This was just something completely brand new that I never had processed as a real child or as an adult. I didn't know what to do with myself.
And even the Huskies, it was tempered.
Yeah, it's a share.
It was shared.
And it's the USA Today side of the share.
God, that's
it's
right.
It's not even the good side of the share.
I don't think the AP has any more credit. Like,
I know, but as Seattle as we are, I always felt like we were still slighted because we didn't get the AP. We got the USA Today one.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. It's a bitter fruit. But yeah, no, and the other thing is that you feel like you have to enjoy it in that exact moment, right? Mm. You can't, you've been waiting so long for it that you feel like you have to be enjoying it as it happens. You can't let go of it. You can't back away from it because it, you know, by now it's been a week. How do you feel about it now, Scott? Are you still elated? Are you still euphoric now?
I am.
Are you?
I am. I am, every time I am walking around and I still see a 12th man flag flying, I get warm inside. Every time I see my Seahawks hat that I bought, I've been holding off Seahawks hat forever. I finally bought one with Super Bowl patch. I get super excited. It's almost like a pinch me kind of situation. And I'm still riding that high. And the Mariners tried to fuck it up by having all this terrible news be announced in the first day of spring training, but it's still there.
And you haven't thought even for a moment about, well, can we get Bennett back for next year? What's Golden Tate's cap hit going to be?
No, I absolutely think about those things, but I think that the Seahawks, I'm not really concerned until another year. Like, I think they can lose Michael Bennett, they could lose Golden Tate, and I still think they could be like a 13-3 team, even if they lost and they had to cut a few people, because at this point it's almost like it's gone the other way, right? Like, as Mariner fans, we're so now conditioned to have this like irrational fear that every decision that the front office makes is going to go wrong. With the Seahawks, I now have this confidence, this weird confidence that it doesn't matter if we lose any. We can lose him. John Schneider will just draft a sixth round D end that will get 10 sacks next year and he'll be a monster. Yeah, we can lose Golden Tate. He'll pick up some, he'll get an undrafted free agent like Doug Baldwin who'll step in and he'll just be fine. You know, it's just like, the two are so far apart at this point. And it's isn't it fun though? I mean, it's so fun as a fan to just have these like completely polar opposite kind of feelings. Of course, I really only get to write about one of them. And
yeah.
Of course, we get stuck with the one that's what's miserable. So, but I've really enjoyed being that kind of a rational fan with the Seahawks because I'm so analytical and I have a responsibility with the Mariners, and it's fun to just like let go with the Seahawks and just not. I mean, I wrote about that. I wrote about the Mariners and the Seahawks, and I wrote about how fun it is to be a fan of the Seahawks because I don't know everything there is to know about football. I don't know all the X's and O's. Where I feel like baseball, I have a very strong understanding of the game. I really understand the analytics of it, and I really understand the inefficiencies and the whole system. And I love not knowing 100%. I still know football pretty well, but I don't know like 100% of it. And it's so freeing, isn't it? It's just freeing to kind of like look at a game and not really know everything. It makes you like think about what it was like to watch baseball when you were a kid.
Right. And so is that such a terrible thing in baseball?
No, not at all.
Because I feel like there's a certain level of pressure, certainly on us. Well, you at least. No one's going to pressure me about it. But to be as factual as possible is to be as accurate as possible. You're a journalist of sorts.
Of sorts.
And I am not. I don't think I would be. I'd be terrible at it.
Well, I consider you more of a journalist than me.
You think so?
Yeah, well, I consider you a better writer than me.
That has nothing to do with being a journalist. Being a journalist is about providing factual information. Facts are horrible.
There's no fun in facts.
No, there really isn't. And I think that if you were tied to facts, the Mariners are going to be really difficult this year.
Yeah, that's why we try and write so much stuff about our emotion. We try and, I mean, God bless Jeff and everything he did for Lookout Landing, because he added so much you know, personality to Mariners. I mean, not what he did for Lookout Landing, but what he did for anybody who ever followed the Mariners ever was putting real honest emotion so that you had things that you could relate to that weren't necessarily facts. I mean, right. that's why I loved reading the site, and that's why I, you know, I love the recap structure that we have at the site, because it doesn't have to be about, oh, look, they lost 8-0 again, and they put in Lucas Litchie when they had a 5-0 deficit, and he ended up coughing up 6 more runs.
That's exactly when you put him in, though. At least they used him right. Process.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like and this is partially having a kid and partially having absolutely no free time or any time to think coherently. But I really feel myself reevaluating my fandom right now. Not because I feel any differently about the Mariners, but simply because I feel differently about my ability to invest in them.
Sure. But what's changed really for you?
I can't research anymore. I work and I get home and I take care of the kid and we put the kid down for bed. It's 9 and I usually have to get to sleep by 10.
No. Then you open a bottle of shitty white Merlot.
Yeah, there we go.
You do a podcast.
I have finished off my glass somehow. I don't remember drinking any of it.
How's the headache? Pretty good?
Behringer White Merlot. I think they actually owe me like $1.50 podcast now. But no, I would love to be a better writer, and I'd love to know more about the game, and I would love to know to be able to dive deeper in, and I'm simply, you know, I always assumed that lack of talent would be the constraint on how far I went as a person and as a writer.
Right.
And it turns out it had nothing to do with it. It's just time. And I won't have the time to be able to study the game as well. I won't even be able to have the time to watch games as closely as I used to. But I still love baseball just as much. And so I have to figure out how I'm going to reconcile these things
right. For
myself. So that's going to be a spiritual journey that is totally uninteresting to everyone else.
I don't think that's uninteresting. I love that kind of stuff. I love hearing perspective, because especially with baseball, it's consumed in such a unique way by so many people. It's not like football where, okay, everybody watches the Seahawks on Sunday, right? It's one day a week. You sit down, and football by nature is very, you know, communal. You know, like you go to a bar with a bunch of people and you watch it because it's a one day a week kind of event. Baseball it's constant. It is always, and it is inconsistent because it has to be by nature. And that's right. What's so interesting about hearing how people consume it. Like, I don't watch every Mariners games. I can't watch every Mariner game. I have things going on. I'll watch the replay the next day or something like that, or I'll watch the condensed game, but it's impossible to watch them all. And as your life situation changes, you consume baseball just a little bit different every single year. And that's what creates these kind of unique memories and perspectives that kind of shape your fandom. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, and the other thing about baseball as opposed to football, in football, everything means something.
Yeah.
Everything is predictive because there's only, you know, so many plays. Whereas in baseball, nothing means anything. You know, 3 home runs in a game has no predictive qualities whatsoever.
Right.
You know, Tuffy Rhodes. So even the things you're enjoying don't, you know, first of all, they don't mean anything because they're baseball. But they also don't mean anything because they have nothing to do with future baseball.
And they also don't mean anything because they're the Mariners.
And then the Mariners. So I think that that's part of it. I think I have to let go of winning.
Yeah.
Even if they're good this year, God knows, I'd love for them to be good. But even if they are, that I still can't consume it that way.
Yeah, but you'll.
Visual thing.
You'll find a new way to consume it that means something different to you. You'll create something unique because you know losing, you know only sort of following in the Mariners, but you don't know only sort of following in the Mariners when they're good. Like you've never followed the Mariners with a child.
Right.
When they've been good. And it'll create this new kind of unique experience for you. And I'm sure it'll be something.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be frustrating at times, and it'll be nice at times. There will be certainly nights when I don't have to write a recap, and you will, and that'll be great for me.
Not if I have anything to say about it.
And there'll be other times when I'll want to watch the game, and the kid will be vomiting. And, you know, there's just... That's how it goes. But that's how baseball goes. It's all still random.
Hey, it's a Mariners. Sometimes we'll have to watch a game and we'll all be vomiting.
We'll all vomit. Symbolically vomiting.
We'll symbolically vomit. Okay, let's see. We're right about an hour here. It's the normal podcast length. I suppose we'll wrap it up. Hey, pretty good. We had absolutely nothing planned, and I think that was a very wonderful discussion.
Yeah, that worked pretty well. By the way, Hisashi Wakuma led for B-War for the American League. I'm looking at the leaderboard, the top 10 for all of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Yu Darvish is 10th. Okay. Do you want to know who tied him in the National League?
National League pitcher or position?
It's a pitcher. This is only pitchers. So the top eight are Kershaw, Lee, Iwakuma, Sale, Scherzer, Fernandez, Sanchez, Wainwright. All eight excellent pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Darvish is 10. Tied with him is a National League pitcher.
Matt Harvey.
For the Colorado Rockies, you get one guess.
For the Colorado Rockies? What?
Yep.
Rafael Betancourt?
No.
I mean, I don't even like...
Yeah, you know, Jimenez wasn't on the team anymore. So the ninth best pitcher in terms of BWAR for last year was...
Hold on. Okay, I got to think about the rotation. I have to think about the rotation.
Look up their roster for last year.
What's that?
You may look up their roster for last year.
Okay.
You may not look at their stats. You have to look on, on MLB.com for their active roster.
Rockies roster. Okay, I'm not looking at it. Is he still on their team? Could I look at the 40-man?
He's still on their team.
Okay.
You could look
I'll just look at their active 40-man roster. No stats. Okay.
I don't think they've changed any pitchers.
Yeah.
Except they got Brett Anderson.
They got Brett Anderson. Okay. Jeez. Chacin?
Chacin.
Ulysses
Chacin.
That's the only guy it could possibly be.
Well, Jorge De La Rosa won 16 games, but...
wins.
Yeah, exactly. I only have to say that two more times and Brian Kenny will burst in here and start beating me up. Ulysses Chacin, 5.8.
Wow.
Yeah, and he'll be lucky to get half that this year.
Yeah, jeez.
But that's B-War. That's why B-War is so great.
He had a pretty good year last year, though, didn't he? I mean, not that good, but, I mean, you know.
He outperformed his peripherals, shall we say.
Let's see that. Yeah.
Let's see what his FWAR was. That's
solid. Boy, what happened to that strikeout rate, man?
Yeah.
He used to be a guy who, I remember when he was a rookie, he was striking out, a batter per inning.
So, Chacin's FWAR was 4.3. Still pretty good.
That's still pretty damn good.
Yeah, his K per nine is 5.75. Wow. His pitch types.
Control, though. Yeah, I mean, that's... You don't have to strike out a lot of guys if you don't walk anybody.
He hasn't really lost much on his fastball either. He had 90.7 in 2009. He's got 89.9 in 2013.
I don't watch enough of the Rockies to really have an informed opinion here.
Well, you know,
If I had 15 minutes to go to his Brooks baseball page and look at everything, I could fake it for an article, but,
I'm not even seeing anything that in his pitch selection that's really changing much either. It's very interesting. Yeah, go write an article about him.
Mm-mm.
Do that.
No, thanks. I'm good.
Watch, you'll get traded to the Mariners tomorrow and you'll have to write about it.
Please don't. I know. They're probably trying. I know they're trying to add a pitcher one way or another. They'll probably trade for someone.
Franklin would look good in Colorado.
Franklin would look great in a White Sox uniform. I'll take Jose Quintana right now. Thank you. See you later. So I want. They're not going after they traded away. What's his name? Hector Santiago, though. That's probably not going to happen anymore. That was my. dream, and then they went and thinned out their rotation, so they're probably not making a deal like that anymore.
You know, they gotta play for 2014 after all.
Yeah, well, they did sign Abreu, and what is the deal there? They still have Adam Dunn, Paul Konerko, and Abreu, right?
And they got Dion Viciedo too.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Justin Smoke for Adam Dunn, straight up. Who says no?
Oh God! But wait. How would I feel about that? Like knowing that Dunn, I probably hate it just because of the salary. There'd have to be a pretty significant salary leap.
Okay, let's say this. We'll say Adam Dunn is making something like what, $14 million next year. Let's say he's making $14 million. The White Sox say we'll eat half of it. You get Adam Dunn for $7 million, or Justin Smoke for what, 3.5 or whatever he's making this year.
Yeah, it's got to be more than seven. I would take Dunn on for, and mostly not because I think he's any better than Smoke at this point.
Right.
Just because he's more fun for me to watch. And partially because at some point we need variety in the people that we hate. You know, it's an underrated thing. We need new villains. And I'm Justin Smoke, sure, villain for far too long. It's time to write him out. But that said, I'd only pay five.
You'd pay five. So you would pay more for Adam Dunn, age 34, with a horribly aging skill set.
You know what? I did explain how I don't care if they win, right?
Yeah, you did. You qualified that.
Yeah, I did. And let's see. He had, my God, I mean, he had a -3 WAR season in 2011. Yep. Think how beautiful that would be.
One of the worst offensive seasons from a first baseman DH ever, if not the worst.
Yeah, I mean, his offense was worse than his defense.
Yeah.
In 2011.
Which is impressive. Can you believe he was an outfielder for a long time?
Yeah, he was. And a terrible one. He was always terrible.
Jeez.
He's never had a positive defense season, even when he was 21 years old. And they kept him out there for years and years and years. But, like,
6'6", what, 290? Good.
You know, at some point, I actually enjoy the Adam Dunn's just because he hit .159 in almost 500 plate appearances.
Incredible.
And at some point, the morbid curiosity sets in, right? And when you're, especially once you get to September, like, having something interesting, like, can Adam Dunn be that bad, is better than nothing, better than watching Joe Saunders pitch.
Right. Now, I think they might have cut him off just short of, like, regular leaderboards that year, yeah, or something.
He didn't qualify.
Right. So he doesn't show up when they do worst seasons ever, when it's, like, qualified at-bats or plate appearances, because I think he fell just short. That year.
What a shame. We should look through his game logs to see if they, like, benched him for the last week of the season.
They did bench him quite a bit down the stretch, actually, yeah, if I remember correctly.
They should. I mean, he's a -3 win player.
Good God.
I mean, he's basically Unieski Betancourt.
Worse than Uni.
I don't know. I don't think Uni got 500 last year. Let's take a look at Unieski. I think Unieski Betancourt had... I think he did what he did in, like, 350.
No, he wasn't that bad. No,
I... He was -1.8, and it was 400 plate appearances. So he would have gotten to about -2 point something.
Okay. All right. Now, what happened? He signed somewhere, right? Did he go over?
He's in Japan.
He's
yeah.
in Japan. Okay, good for him.
No. I want him back.
I kind of agree. I want to live in a world where I wake up in the morning and Ruben Amaro Jr. has signed Unieski Betancourt and Delman Young on the same day and just said, hey, guys, you are the left side of the field.
And maybe this is the thing with Adam Dunn. Maybe I don't need the Mariners to have Adam Dunn. I just, if the Mariners had Adam Dunn, I would notice. And maybe it's my fault for not being more, like, he was there in 2011. I could have enjoyed that. I just didn't really think about it. We need some sort of way to appreciate the failures of players that aren't on our teams. I wrote about Eduardo Perez one time. And half of the joy of writing of that article is that he wasn't a Mariner anymore. And just being able to, like, yeah, I'm writing about Eduardo Perez, and he's sucking for somebody else. That's a great feeling. But I guess you have to have him before you lose him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we need to have Adam Dunn, and then, well, then, you know, he'd be done. If we cut him, it'd be a Jack cut situation. We'd never see him again.
It's true. I'm not sure Adam Dunn would make it out of May.
But if there's like a King Ralph situation, I want to dream of these sorts of things.
This is what it's come to. We debate which would be the better of two terrible first base options for 2014.
And we have to create some sort of really horrific thing to happen for it to take place, right? We're now to the point where people are getting like West Nile virus or something. We're actually wishing hypothetical, and I say we when I'm it's me doing it. I'm using the royal we here. I'm creating all, you know, increasingly horrific things that would happen in order for the statistical abnormality that I enjoy
right.
to take place. It's yeah, that's the edge. That's the edge of something.
Oh God, too good. I love it. Well, misery is just a short month and a half around the corner because spring training lasts forever. God, why?
Yeah, so that everyone can go except for me, probably.
I'm going.
That's it. Yeah, everyone's going. I can't go this year.
It's actually my first time. I've never been to spring training before, so I'm
going to enjoy it.
I'm going to go.
It's great. It's wonderful. Wear the backpack that you can have water in, whatever that thing is, the Camelback. Just bring two.
All right.
It's hot. It's horrible. But
okay. I might also just drink beer and
or you could,
dehydration later. Always a solid option. All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your white Merlot. I think it's time for you to pour yourself another glass.
I think I got to get some Advil first.
And appreciate you hopping on this edition of the podcast After Dark.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Take it easy, man.